एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
Hi, my name is Srinath. I'm one of the co-founders of this company called Agnikul Cosmos, where we build small rockets.
I've often seen my child pretending to be riding a rocket to explore the solar system. And this is such a universal dream that some of the richest men in the world are putting in considerable resources into building rockets and escaping Earth's gravity, even if it's just for a short while. And I'm really proud to present our guest for the show, a man who has built together an amazing organization that is building a Made in India rocket that will be completely 3D printed and will allow the world to launch things into space cheaply and quickly. Srinath Ravichandran has had an amazing journey, starting from his humble beginnings in Chennai to a career in Wall Street firms to finally returning back to Chennai to set up Agnikul Cosmos, which is currently just a year away from launching its first rocket to space and making India very proud. Here's Srinath telling Akshay Dutt about how he developed an interest in science and physics.
My mom is a physics teacher and my dad is a civil engineer.
Okay, so there was a certain like a certain respect for science while you were growing up as a kid, like it must have got you curious about science as a discipline.
Absolutely. Actually, it's more than just my mom and dad. I grew up in with my maternal grandparents as well in the same building, and my granddad as well as an electronics engineer, and my aunt, who's my mom's sister, she's also a physics teacher. So yeah, I've had my fair dose of being exposed to science early on, and particularly physics early on. Yes.
Did you have like any mad scientist experiments as a kid which went wrong or something like that?
No, not really. But I was actually a very avid reader of. So I think when I was like some 10 years old or something around that age, I got this quiz book. It was called Astronomy Quiz Book. I don't know if they still make those. Should actually look it up now that I'm telling this to you. That actually is like this, you know, sort of this. It's actually for that age group, somewhere between, you know, 8 to 12 years. And it's about all these, it's like an FAQ format book. So it's not like you're actually reading a textbook, which feels very dense at that age, right? And at the same time, it's also not like too little. It actually has a lot of this question answers, and all answers are about like a couple of paragraphs.
Something like, which is the biggest planet and stuff like that.
Yeah. But they go a little deeper than that. But yes, that's exactly right. So that's where that's what I did when I was really young. No mad experience.
So that like sparked your passion for space. Were you also into like, you know, science fiction and stuff like that?
Yes. That's actually exactly how my curiosity for space started, because of this astronomy quiz book, I think. And then after that, there was this lending library, if you remember, those things used to exist.
Yeah, I remember.
Someone told me about this book called 2001 A Space Odyssey. So, and that is actually around, I think, when I was in like 7th or 8th standard or something like that. So I read that, and I think after that, I pretty much decided that I have to do something or the other in space. that's basically how it started.
And so, like, did you know by the time you were like, you know, 15 or so, that you want to do an aeronautical engineering or something equivalent? Or did you have dreams of going to the US and working at NASA? Or, you know, like, what kind of dreams did you have by the time you were of that age?
Oh, very interesting question. So I had no idea what I should be doing, even though I loved space, right? And everything about space, but I didn't know really what I should be doing for a profession as such. right? At least at that time, it seemed very different things. Oh, you love physics and aerospace, but okay, what job are you going to do? Those two seemed like very different questions. And when I was in 10th standard, there was this competition called Red Rover Goes to Mars. And that was actually conducted by NASA, I think, with ISRO. And they were actually having a few people below 15 years of age actually participate in designing a systems level design of a rover that will be in Mars by 2019 or so. So I got selected in that one as a national semi-finalist. I actually had an opportunity to go to ISRO. That was my first actual experience of visiting ISRO and all. This was in 2000. So all that was happening. So yes, there were things about like going to Mars and all those dreams in me. But at the same time, there were a lot of reality checks happening on the, on the personal front. Like really, what kind of a job are you going to get? If you are not able to get into ISRO, then pretty much you don't have any career for you. And all those things are also coming from a lot of people around. So I decided that probably a safer route is okay. And I actually just liked all aspects of engineering. It was not, space was definitely a top favorite, but it's not like only favorite. So the next favorite thing for me was electronics, actually. So, and that is where I, that is where I actually ended up doing a bachelor's in electrical and electronics engineering from College of Engineering, Indy in Chennai. I wanted to do aerospace, but then it felt okay to actually keep these two separate. I love physics, but I love aerospace, but I can do something in electronics. It seemed okay. It didn't seem like a big thing at that point. But that's how the story started.
So, Guindy is in Chennai or how far is it?
Yes. Yeah, it's in Chennai. I was a day scholar, not a hostel.
Okay. So, what was the placement scene like by the end of your BTech? Did you have more clarity on what you want to do and like a more practical approach towards life, that I need to get a job and start earning and get my head out of the stars, so to say?
Practical approach, yeah, okay. We could call it that. Interesting choice of words. So anyway, I think two things happened. One thing I was very clear was that I didn't want to directly get into any job. I wanted to at least make it feel like, okay, I've studied something for 4 years and I should do something in that. And I actually liked what I was studying. It was not like I got into engineering because I had no clue what else to do, right? So it is, so I liked it. So I was very careful about applying only for like electrical engineering oriented jobs or electronics oriented jobs. Then got into ABB. I think Swedish company, right? They make like these large electrical appliances and stuff. So got in there, and actually I was doing motor design and drive design and all that stuff for like motors that are used in huge industries. Like I remember actually working on a controller for a motor which was turning the blast furnaces in steel plants in India, in Bokaro steel plant actually. So fascinating stuff. I never have seen actually a motor tilt a furnace full of molten iron. It's really awesome to see it if you have not seen. So that is what I was doing. But I also felt like the design part of it, which is what I thought was, my passion there or my interest there, was not really getting satisfied because these things are already well designed. I was doing the last bit of fine tuning and, last bit of
documentation and, yeah.
Wouldn't say documentation, it was more like service or fine tuning, right? So someone designs a drive, but then you need to make it work for that motor and that application and that environment, which is more like adapting it to that. It didn't feel challenging enough to me at that point. So, and then, everyone has this group of friends that he or she hangs out with when they're in college. And for me, it just so happened that everyone in my close group actually ended up doing something in finance at that point. They were either doing, CAT and going for like an MBA somewhere, or people, they were getting placed in investment banks directly. So, and I was a complete beginner in that area. I had no idea of what is finance. In the sense, I just knew that there is something called balance sheet, but even that, I didn't really know what has to be done there and all that stuff. So I was very intrigued actually by this whole area. And this 2 years of doing this kind of a role also kind of made me feel like, hey, is this what engineering is? I mean, it's not less fascinating as it sounds. And so I actually decided I should really go and take a look at finance, because literally everyone around me was doing something in finance at that time. So that's when I quit that job at ABB and then went for a master's program in financial engineering. I don't know if you've heard of that course, financial engineering. It's actually a branch of engineering which takes a lot of the sophisticated models from physics and applies it to stock markets. Okay, so you talk about things that probably quantum mechanics folks would talk about, but you apply to stock markets, and it's amazing because both of these are unpredictable. You might have heard of quantum stuff being unpredictable, right? So they try to apply the same thing to stock markets,
which is called as quant trading.
Yeah. The outcome of that is quant trading. Yes, that's right. Quant is the quantitative part of that trading. Yes. So that is a course I got an admit in, and this was 2008. So, and it was in New York, and I mean, I had not gone outside the country before that. And
how did you afford this? Because I mean, you're from a middle income family, you know, like going studying in New York sounds expensive.
Yeah. It was a 1 year course, and I pretty much asked around all relatives I could without being too ashamed of it. And I also, was able to take some loans. So yeah, some hybrid between all this, I was able to work it out. Also, the promise was very clear. You're going to New York in a finance course. I mean, seriously, you can repay any loan in within 6 months. That was the pitch I was getting, right? So I was like, yeah, okay, just a small investment for a long-term return. So I went, but it was 2008. And as I told you before, I didn't know anything about finance. And I didn't know that there was one of the biggest crises in the entire history of finance brewing at that point. Little did I know, right? That was what was lurking behind. So I went in 2008, June, to New York. And I realized that every week that passed by, there was one less company to apply to for a job. And so all of the things that I had... So, and I don't know if you know this, but when in movies, when you see New York, there is a bias to show the Midtown part of New York, the Wall Street part of New York. There is a lot of New York that is outside of this, right? And I went to Columbia University, actually. I got an admit in Columbia, so I went there. And that was basically the borderline of where things start to change in terms of appearances. Like, that is not the New York that people show you in films. So that's when I realized, okay, reality is actually slightly gray. And also the professional part of it was quite bad, because already people were getting fired and things were really bad. Only people with some finance background were getting jobs, because no company wanted to invest in a person to train them from him or her from scratch. But then one good thing that was happening is because so many people were losing money left, right, center. I mean, from a company standpoint, a lot of risk management firms were hiring. And financial engineering was the in thing at that time. It was actually one of the things that caused the crisis. If you have seen movies like, I forgot the name now, but the
Margin one. Margin Call.
Yeah, Margin Call is a good example. There's also this other movie which is a little more funny, right? Because Margin Call is a very serious movie. There was still this belief in using financial engineers to hedge risk. So that is where I came in. So bankruptcy firms were hiring, risk management firms were hiring. I got into risk management of a company called AXA. You might have seen Bharti AXA here in India, right? So that's where I got in. I was called in to take care of the portfolio risk that comes in from, so insurance premiums come in and people actually invest it somewhere, and that's how they return, whatever schemes you have gotten into with the insurance company. So that money has to be managed, and they were losing a lot of money in that management at that time because the stock market was really bad. And I had to come in to be part of a team that was hedging that risk out. So that is where my finance career started.
So AXA is a insurance company like any insurance company in India, like say ICICI Prudential, or it's like that only? Or
yeah, it is like that only. But they offer a very complex financial products. So there are products which are focused on retirement benefits. Meaning, say for example, for the next 20 years of your life, if you pay say $1,000 every month, then after you retire, you're guaranteed $10,000 every month. Something like that, right? Like they do that investment for you. So those kind of, I think we have similar products here within Indian.
Yeah, like this is called a pension plan. Yeah.
It's about pension plans and coming up with annuities for that and so on. Yes. So that's what I started off in finance with.
Yeah. So, okay. So, you know, I'm going to dig a little deeper here. So this, like, AXA collects money from people who are currently earning and putting away for old age, and it invests that money in the stock market, and that is how it gives them back much more money when they retire. And your job was to protect the value of that investment.
Precisely. That's actually they don't do it only in stock market. They do it in a bunch of vehicles, right? Stock market is one of them. They also do it in bonds. They do it in, you know, more, like they also put some money in hedge funds and so on. So they diversify their portfolio. So yeah, and I came in to make sure that they don't.
Like, how would you protect it? Tell me the tools that are available.
Okay. So I thought we'd be talking more about aerospace, but anyway, I did this for 6 years, so definitely I can talk about that.
Like I told you, you know, I'm going to let my curiosity guide me. So.
Sure. No, this is fun. So the way we do it is, so people usually have a portfolio allocation, you know, framework, right? And they use models to say where money should be. But then there are certain well-identified risks that come in. Say, for example, with whatever portfolio you are in, you can always come up with what people call Greeks, if you're aware of that term.
No.
Basically, it means that, okay, you put, say, you have 100 rupees and you put 40 rupees in stocks and 60 rupees in bonds. And then tomorrow, the Nifty or whatever, Sensex moves up and down by 1%. You're going to lose this much percentage of your 100 rupees. So that is the sensitivity of that 100 rupees to that market change, right? So that's called a Greek, basically. Greek as in, I think it's coming from the mathematical concept of a derivative. Basically, what will be for a small change in your Sensex, what is your portfolio going to take as a hit? So I come in and say, hey, this is what the Greek for this portfolio is. And by the way, there are some interesting financial products available wherein if we buy that, then it sort of acts like a hedge, wherein if I'm supposed to lose 1%, I won't lose that 1%. I'll only lose 0.01 because I bought this extra instrument.
And those instruments would be like what, like say short selling related stuff?
Those would be like call options or put options, basically. So if you use, particularly if you want to protect your portfolio's worth from going down when there is a market down, stock market down, you'll probably buy a put option on that put on these.
What is a call option and a put option? I mean, you know, I studied all this stuff like 20 years back in my MBA. I've completely forgotten it. But
okay. So a call option is basically like, you know, you're entering into a contract with someone who says, and you're betting with them saying that, hey, if the market goes up beyond this certain money, I will still be able to buy the stock from you at a lower price. So basically, it's betting on things going bad, getting better. And a put option is actually the reverse. You're basically buying.
I will be let's able say, to sell you.
At a higher price. Exactly. Even if the market goes lower. So basically, what we do to hedge out stock market risk is you find out how sensitive you are to the market from your portfolio. And you end up buying a portfolio of options. Say, I'll buy a little bit of calls, I'll buy some puts, and then make sure that if my market moves, my stocks will lose money, but my options will gain in their worth. And so I'm net okay. So that's basically what I was doing.
Okay. So this is exactly what financial engineering is.
It's one aspect of financial engineering.
One aspect of it. Okay. So, and I imagine like small stuff that you would do would lead to big revenue impact.
Yeah. There was a lot of, I mean, I got really lucky in that sense. because the team I was working in was managing billions of dollars of derivatives, or all these options, right? The more the finance jargon for that is derivatives, right? So derivatives. And I was literally sitting there day in and day out. It was like a trading floor. So every day there'll be all these staggering numbers of, oh my God, we gained this much. Oh my God, we didn't lose this much, and all these things. So it was very, very, hands-on in terms of impacting the bottom line of the company, that team particularly. So yes, so that gave me a lot of satisfaction the initial period at AXA, because I knew that what I was developing models for, or what decisions we were making, would directly save the company money. And that was a very, very satisfying feeling for some time.
Was it very much like a boiler room kind of a, like, you know, people with three or four monitors in front of them? And
Yeah, I had four monitors. But it was not it was not like the trading floor you would see in the movie kind of a thing, because there are not like so many people out there. It was not like a, say, Morgan Stanley trading floor or Goldman Sachs trading floor, right? Because it's not like we had hundreds of people doing this. We had like some 10 people or 20 people doing it. And that area used to look like that, yes. And we were so market driven, like we live and die by what the market does, right? Basically, until 6 p.m. New York time. Basically, 6 p.m. New York time is where nothing happens. And then there is this half an hour before Tokyo wakes up and market starts. So the 6 to 6:30 is when you really get your free time. After that, again, you have to watch out for Japan exposure. And after Japan, it comes India, then comes Europe, then again back to US. So it used to be around the clock. And Friday evenings were great, because Friday evening, 6 o'clock was amazing. That is the time when literally no market in the world was open. Till Sunday night, 9 p.m. Yeah. So I've been, for a very long time, my weekends always ended at Sunday 9 p.m. Because Japan opens by then. New York time, Sunday 9 p.m. MC.
Got it. Okay. So you must have been working with, like, you know, the top 1% of the smartest people in the world kind of a thing there.
Oh, yeah. That was that. I consider myself lucky today that, you know, I met some amazing people, both in my course at Columbia University and after that at AXA as well. I still actually, use some of the things that I learned from them. But that's easy to say now. At that time, it was soul crushing because I was okay academically all along my school years and college and all that, right? I mean, I was not like a topper, but within, let's say, the top five, top six, always, like, academics was never like a problem for me. So I was always sort of this okay performer. And so I had this image about, you know, okay, I'm fine. Okay. And then you go meet these people and you're like, oh my God. Ouch. Okay, I have to basically rewrite my image of who I am. So that's a little scary. But it was actually, it also, I think, happened at the right time, because it is at a time where you're okay. At least for me, around those early 20s, right? That is when my personality was also, I think, my opinion of myself was getting formed properly. And it got rooted in the right kind of reality. Because I met some really awesome people and I realized, oh my God, okay. I need to find what is there in me that I'm different from them in some other skills that they're really, really good at. So, yes.
But it must have been like, you know, the way a diamond gets polished, you know, that kind of a high performance environment with very, very competitive peers.
Yeah, I mean, see, actually, it is right. I don't know about the diamond part and all, but people were very nice. I'm lucky there, right? I obviously, it just happened that people around me were not nasty. They were not like, you know, there was no corporate bullshit and none of that stuff. But it's just the kind of value that they were bringing on with the kind of amount of hours of work they were putting in. And what I was doing was like not comparable in some sense. I'm like struggling to get this code to work for like 6 hours, and that guy just finished it in like 2 hours, and actually it runs faster than my code. What am I doing? And, you know, so that kind of feeling, right? So it was pressure. It was not pressure to
Why were you writing code? Was it to run simulations or what was the code for?
Code was for multiple things. One is to run simulations of if the market does a certain thing, what the portfolio would do. It was also for like building trading tools. So we had to figure out ways where we had to, all these rules of thumb, right? I basically, one thing if I learned from finance is the amazing thing about rules of thumb, right? Like finance is full of shortcuts and all these really interesting shortcuts wherein it don't tell you exactly what will happen, but it'll really give you a good idea of what's going, what to predict.
What are they? Give me some examples of rules of thumb.
No, rules of thumb as in like, say, for example, even this whole Greek thing I told you about, right? What will happen to your portfolio if there's a change in the market and if 1% market change happens, right? That's a first cut approximation of your value erosion or value creation. Similarly, there are all these metrics. I remember I used to work for the head of trading there, and their questions used to always come like, okay, tomorrow if the, so in New York, it was S&P 500, right? That is their market index. So tomorrow the S&P 500 moves by 5% and the Nikkei, the Japan one, right? Nikkei moves down by 2%. What will happen to the portfolio? And you had to come up with, so if you're not really thinking of how to answer these questions, your Sunday is ruined. So we used to come up with all sorts of shortcuts to what is the quickest, and you know, it could be dirty and it could be like dirty in the sense like very simplistic, but what is the quickest way to estimate something? It's always question like, okay, tomorrow market crashes by 20%, what will happen to the portfolio?
So essentially it honed your ability to take decisions with a lot of data, which you may not necessarily be able to register all of it, but you were able to like absorb the data and take decisions.
Yeah. It made me think of like, it made me come up with systems wherein even though there is a ton of information to process, always the answer has to be in 10 seconds.
Wow, that's an amazing skill to have.
If you heard of, people, generally traders not having patience, it's very true, right? So they don't, and they just move on. If you get asked a question and you don't answer in 10 seconds, they move on, and it will make, at least me, make me feel very bad, because it just felt like, God, why am I not able to answer the question, right? So what I ended up doing is, like, particularly on Fridays and before going home and all these lean times, right, I used to just come up with all these small rules of thumb for myself. So, and all these numbers, there are like hundreds of numbers. Each Excel sheet is like, you know, one megabyte, 1 MB, 2 MB, but doesn't matter. What matters is, can you answer that question in 5 seconds? So that actually made me abstract away a lot of useless information. It taught me how to do that. And I actually still find that very useful. Very interestingly, because probably of my finance years today for rocket building, which is what we do, we have a lot of rules of thumb. And I have been telling the team to work on that. So anyway, that's for a different part of the chat. Anyway.
So, like, moving on from AXA, like, did you like make the switch for more money when you joined AIG, or was it for a different portfolio, or what was the thing?
No, I think so. I was working in AXA. I was doing this. I loved it. I learned a lot, but I was an engineer at heart. I think my dream for space never really went away. So I decided that I should just go quit all this and go to aerospace, because that is really what will give me fulfillment. But at the same time, I was also actually already starting to doubt what am I doing, because I already changed once from electrical to finance. Now I'm going back from finance to some engineering. Is this just me just being impatient with things, or is it really something that is my calling? I had no idea.
So, was it a Elon Musk effect? Like, you know, that to even think that you can leave a job in finance and do something in space. I mean, you know, say 2 decades back, it would have been like unbelievable to hear somebody thinking like that. But, you know, people like Elon Musk have made it possible to think like that.
Yeah, it was definitely that part as well. That was a reason why I took up a job in LA, right? I wanted to be around SpaceX. But at the same time, I think what was also happening is I was simply getting really restless with my professional work, And I felt like I cannot continue on like this, right? I had to give it a shot. So that was there. Of course, that was the time when, you know, rocket launches started becoming a big deal in the US. And, you know, we had this biography of Musk come out. And then at the same time, we had the Steve Jobs autobiography, you know, biography came out at that time. So all these books also shaped my ability to take risk, right? But this restlessness was there constantly, which is why I actually also, because a lot of people started telling me around me that, you know, I might be confused. And the feedback I heard is, hey, you know what, maybe just live with this for some time, you will get used to it. It's not that hard. I mean, a lot of people would really long to be in the place where you are in today. You are in New York in finance. It doesn't get better than this, right? And I was in front office as well, right? So meaning very close to where trading is, or in the trading floor itself. So that is like as good as it gets in finance, basically, right? That is where you, after that is the team to be in to become the CFO or something like that. That is where people raise up the ranks in that range. So that was there. So actually, that's when I ended up doing a lot of other things, because I really wanted to understand who I am as a person.
Okay. That's when you got into making films.
Yeah. That's where my 3 years of part-time filmmaking school happened. And I really just want to understand, like, what am I good at? Because as you also rightly asked, how was it working with really talented people, right? It basically makes you question what you think about yourself. But then you do realize there is something in you that will work. You just have to find that. It might not be what you thought it is. It's something else, right? So, and for all that, just experimenting generally helps. So that's where, and I always loved films. I don't know when that interest exactly started, but I think I've always been very curious about how films get made. Basically, the concept of storytelling always fascinated me. So that's where that also came in. So yeah, film school is there. And then film school actually helped me make it very clear that I was not cut out for finance. So a lot of those revelations happened. Then I basically quit my job and registered for a master's in aerospace engineering from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, UIUC. That happened, but that was in the middle of nowhere as far as aerospace engineering is concerned. It was in some part of Illinois. Nothing really was happening around that. And US particularly, if you know, like this, it is so geography focused, right? If you want to be in electronics or software, you're probably better off
Silicon Valley
area. Yeah. Exactly, right? And similarly, if you're in finance, if you want to be in finance, you're either in Chicago or in New York, right? So, and similarly in Illinois, nothing was there for aerospace directly. And that is where the feeling came, okay, I need to be around space. And that is what drove me to LA. And I was on a visa. I needed a job. I can't just be I have to either be a full-time student or I have to be a full-time job. Otherwise, I can't be in the US. So that's where the AIG came in, because AIG, they were very similar role to what I did at AXA, was also open at AIG. And it happened to be in an LA location.
And so you did both? Like you joined AIG and you also pursued the...
I converted this to my part-time. Yeah, I converted this to a part-time course, like a evening course basically. And it was done online. And once in a while, I had to visit the university and stuff. But it was more like vocational stuff. So, yeah. And working finance from Los Angeles is really interesting, because your day starts at 6 and it ends at 3:30.
Okay. So it gave you the time to study and like after your day was...
Yeah. Hmm. So usually people go to bed early, but I didn't do that. So I was able to meet a lot of people and network and understand what is this sector that I'm so fascinated about? How is the reality of that sector? And being in LA definitely helped, because meeting so many people who are, first of all, so encouraged by SpaceX, and I happened to meet a few people from SpaceX, which actually was like big wow moments for me. That is these are the people who work there, kind of a feeling, right? So all that happened, and yeah, slowly got used to what this whole sector is about.
If you like to hear stories of founders, then we have tons of great stories from entrepreneurs who have built billion-dollar businesses. Just search for the Founder Thesis podcast on any audio streaming app like Spotify, Gaana, Apple Podcasts, and subscribe to the show.
So, when did you then decide to quit AIG and do space full-time?
That was very clear from the time I quit my New York job itself, actually, right? In the sense it had to be space full time. I just didn't know how to get there. And between two things happened. One, I knew always that I wanted to come back to India at some point. I also was going to get married around that time, around 2017. So that is also what was happening.
So you met someone in the US or this was in India?
I met the person remotely online, but then I actually met her. Mm-hmm.
Like your parents?
No. It was not a arranged kind of marriage. It was more like through some common networks and stuff. A random LinkedIn thing, I think. If I remember.
LinkedIn, wow. not very often you get to hear about people like, you know, getting married through a LinkedIn connection.
It was like some common community, I think, of some Ivy League folks or something like that. So from there it started. Then I met her.
She was working in India.
Yeah. She had been to the US and then she had returned. So
you had that value system match there in the sense that you also wanted to come back to India after working in the US.
Yes. So that's how that started. So I was also looking to come to India for, you know, because of this, right? This was also moving. And also the other thing is being an Indian citizen doing aerospace stuff in a foreign country, not necessarily US, any country is a little hard because it could be construed as technology, which is dual use. And there are a lot of clearances that you need to go through. And it is doable, right? It's definitely doable. The question is, it takes the focus away from technology and puts it on paperwork. And then you're running around solving these paperwork issues as opposed to closing out technology. So that is why I decided India is probably a better place. And one thing that totally caught me by surprise is the respect that ISRO has in the US. No one had told me about it, but when I used to go meet people and tell them that, hey, I'm from India, and if I mention something about ISRO, immediately people, it was almost like they took me seriously just because of ISRO, and I had nothing to do with ISRO at that time. So I realized that actually India is doing really well.
Okay, but was it like a... You know, for example, people from IIT are highly respected, but if you look at, say, the number of research papers and patents that IITs file, they are like much lower than comparable organizations around the world. So was it something similar where somebody who's worked in ISRO then come to the US and therefore has built respect for the ISRO brand? Or was it like ISRO was doing groundbreaking stuff which people were taking notice of?
Yeah, it was more of the latter. ISRO was really doing groundbreaking stuff that no one had done at that time. And it continues that, you know, how is ISRO able to pull it off at these kind of capital cost expenditures, right? I mean, we are one of the most affordable space programs in the entire world. So that is fascinating, right? And I think it's important to keep money in mind because it's not available easily, even at a government level. And you're talking hundreds of millions of dollars being reduced to, you know, say double-digit million dollars, right? So order of magnitude changes and doing successful missions. So that had like, so the Mars missions, the way... in which we did, I think in 2016 actually was the time when there was that 104 satellite launch of ISRO that happened. And at that time, we were the only country in the world that had launched the highest number of satellites in one launch. So all that was already happening, right? And some of the technology that we have accomplished, in particularly in rockets for, you know, commercial satellites, I think is on par with what anyone else has done. So there was so much respect for that part. And that's when I realized, actually, it's not like a bad thing. It's actually probably a good thing to go to India and do it. Because the rest of the world is actually very curious about how India is able to pull this off. So I saw that respect in there. And rocket launches particularly are very, very, it's like a rocket launch is a little bit like music composed by an artist, right? Like anyone can, even if you're not a musician, you get to judge it. Right? I can go and coolly talk about A.R. Rahman song saying, yeah, that was not really cool. Even though I can't compose anything, even one note of it, right? And so I found that very fascinating about, because in other products, you don't get to do that, right? Like if, say, for example, you're writing a software product for some company and you have a big bug, right? So probably your boss is going to be pissed off, and probably your customer, you're going to lose that customer. Probably some 25 people in that network will know. And that's about it. A rocket launch fails, tomorrow your neighbor will ask you what happened.
Yeah, the whole world knows, right?
So it is very public. You're putting your work out there, and doing that, ISRO had gained so much credibility, right? So that is where I think the credibility factor comes. Being able to put technology out there for the entire world to judge, and still getting things right. So that's what basically told me that India is not a bad option. In fact, I soon realized it is actually the best option.
Did you like build a corpus, like save up a corpus to bootstrap it, or you know, like did you like first start by looking for funding? How did you identify that what you want to do? Because I mean, space is such a broad domain, you know. So within that, how did you identify what you want to do? Like tell me about that journey, you know, from a vague itch to something which actually existed.
So there actually the rockets part was very clear. I think I grew up watching Doordarshan launches of PSLV, so that fascination was always there. Then of course going to the US and seeing, you know, SpaceX attempt reusable rockets, that was also there. And then when I did my own networking that I told you about when I was in LA, everyone I met, in fact, from a university, I think I went to about 25, 30 universities in the Southern California area, right? Starting from small community colleges all the way to like really good ones in terms of their ranking. I went to everything, and all of them, I think, had some small satellite sitting in a lab. And I really wondered, why are they not in space? Satellite is not supposed to be in a lab, right? So, and I used to ask the same question actually to people, and everyone was complaining about, like, you know, they were not getting the right kind of vehicle to go to space, and it was not easy to combine with the rest of the people who wanted to go. The orbit they wanted to go to is not where the rocket was going. All sorts of logistic problems. So that's where I came up with this small thought that, okay, actually you should build a really, really small rocket that really quickly takes small satellites and quickly puts it in space. Like all this quickly, this feeling of quickly was there in my head from that time, because people are suffering from a delay. So I was like, you should just build a quick, small rocket to quickly launch things in space and quickly come back, and that's it.
And a reusable rocket?
Reusable or not was actually, I was not very focused on that part of it, but it was more like, okay, if you want to go to space, just you should be able to go to space. It's not like it should not be like so complex from a logistics standpoint, because it's not like technology was not there. We've already been launching rockets from 60s, right? But then still people are stuck with satellites in so many labs. So that is so where
in this... a way you were like looking at the Uberization, like on demand sending to space.
Yeah, it was very much on demand sending to space. I really felt like if someone, like for example, you know, wanted to put something in space for his or her son's birthday or something, it should not be like, oh my God, you need to be be a Jeff Bezos for that. It should not be that hard, right? As long as, it'll be expensive, yes, but it should not be like only the top 1% of the richest people in the world should be able to do that. So that's where it started. And yeah, I mean, after that, I cold called a bunch of, by this time, actually, my other co-founder, his name is Moen. Uh, he, he was also sort of in the middle of a career change and stuff. He was actually, he did his bachelor's in aerospace, and then he's actually fascinated by space law. He's like this, he really tries to examine why exactly, you know, things are right, what is right, what is wrong, all those kind of existential questions, right? Because it's very hard if you think of it, actually. How did we come up with a system to say you are right and I am wrong, right? And you can endlessly debate that. But we still have a system that meaningfully functions, if not perfect, still meaningfully functions. So he was interested about the space aspect of it. So stuff like, who does space belong to? Now, if you end up building a city on Mars, now is that city, you know, some American companies, or is it America's, or whose is it, right? And all of those things. So he was there, and he was also running some sort of a contract manufacturing company in Chennai, because his parents, his dad was not well, and he had to run that because of a family situation. He had stabilized that, and he was also looking to do something in aerospace, which is when I told him about my own, you know, plunge into aerospace. And so it seemed like a natural way for him to also get come in, and that's how he joined the journey. And we both so actually
what's the timeline here? Like, you joined AIG in 16.
Yeah, 2016, and I told the Moen around middle of, like, somewhere around the later part of 2016.
Okay. So those 2 years you spent at AIG, you were also in parallel setting the ground to launch Agnikul.
Yes, exactly. I was doing a lot of work to understand what it means. I was beginner to startups. No one in my family had done any entrepreneurship as such. Space was new. Everything was new. So I had to do a lot of groundwork to understand what it means to do this. Right. So, yeah, that is what.
Tell me about that 2 year journey then. So you found a person who could be a potential co-founder. Then what next?
Oh, no, that came much later, because Moin was told me that during the later part of 2016 or early 2017, actually. Even though we were talking, right, that was not the first thing. First thing for me was to, this is where my finance experience came in. I knew what it meant to go and talk to someone about a business, right? I tried to always ask this question, hey, if I had to go and pitch this to Elon Musk, what would he say? Right, like simply, that was a question I used to ask myself, because I wanted to see how an expert would look at it. Right. So I tried to come up with the business case. I tried to understand what truly does it mean to build a small rocket. Did the market survey for other small rockets out there? Understood if there is really a business you can make out of it. All the questions that later on investors started grilling me on. Right. That is what I was forming the framework for. And at the same time, all the startup jargon, which at least now is seeming very normal to me, but at that time it was completely like, okay, what does it mean to say seed round? What is pre-series A? What is series A? How do you raise money? What's valuation? All those things, from a core finance standpoint, it was easy to understand, but I didn't know the jargon in the industry here. So that kind of work was what was happening for a long time. And then once Moin came in, and also it was around, I think it was, these things lined up. I was actually, my fiance then, my wife now, she had come to visit me, I think in 2016, December, during the Christmas time there, right? And at that time, I was just talking to her about some random thing. And then she suddenly told me about one person on Twitter in Chennai about doing something on aerospace. And then I reached out to him, and he actually connected me to someone who is a part of the IIT Madras community. And then he connected me to someone who is a part of a particular facility within IIT Madras. And that person connected me to Professor Satya Chakravarti, who now is a co-founder of Agnikul. Right. So that's literally how it started, because I was doing a lot of cold calling with Moin, because I was very clear that this will have to be a university affiliation has to be there. Because I didn't have that kind of money to, you know, it was not a PayPal to SpaceX story, right? My Wall Street years were not that luxurious. Okay. So it's not like I had that kind of money. So I knew I needed an academic partner for labs, for infrastructure, for guidance, for access to people to work with. Those things were very clear from the very beginning. And it was also like, I was also seeing those success stories in the US when I was doing my own networking. So that's where things started. And then I cold called so many profs. I mean, Moin and I think we wrote to about 70, 80 IIT professors across the country. Kanpur, Kharagpur, Delhi, Bombay, any meaningful IIT, at least in terms of an aerospace engineering team, right? We wrote. But rightfully so, from their perspective, this was just a bunch of people who had no idea what to do, and they were reaching out trying to see whether they can build rockets. So they would have most likely flagged us as spam, which I might have done today if I were in their shoes, right? Who knows? But so again, not complaining, just saying that's how it happened. But then one person, for some reason, this person, right, who I met through these four degrees of separation, he actually happened to give me a meeting, a video meeting. Then I pitched what was not Agnikul at that time, but some version of Agnikul at that time. And he actually was like, yeah, this is not a bad idea. I myself have thought about building rockets in a few interesting ways. Maybe we should continue talking. And that day I decided, okay, I should start looking for one-way tickets to Chennai. So that's how the story started, basically, of coming back. See, the lucky thing is that it happened in Chennai. Who knows, right? Like I didn't care about Chennai at that point. From LA, Bombay and Chennai are close enough, right? So I was just like, something you should do in India, you should figure it out, maybe Bangalore, who knows. But yeah, it just happened again. I think, as I've already told you so many times, so many things fell in place along whatever I've done so far. I think this is another thing, meeting prof. Yeah, once he showed the slightest amount of interest, it was very clear that I should pack. And that's in December. Actually, I came to Chennai for good in October 2017. And by December 2017, we formally incorporated our.
And he was part of the founding team, or he joined a little later? Like Professor Chakravarti.
He was part of the founding team, very much. Yeah, very, very much part of the founding team. He was a person who told us what can be done, what cannot be done. I mean, he's a rocket scientist himself. And it's like he could at least tell us, you know, how the system functions here. And he sits on a lot of ISRO committee reviews and all that stuff himself. So he had a lot of, you know, connections there. More importantly, he also actually knew people who he connected us to. In fact, he is a person who connected us with Mr. R.V. Perumal, who was actually the father of India's GSLV rocket. So, and he was the first person we pitched to. It was my first pitching meeting with a scientist, and I was super nervous, and probably now I still have the presentation, of course, and it looks very stupid to me now, but anyway, 4-year-old story.
What was the pitch that you were making?
No, for Agnikul only, right? But what the rocket should be like and all that, because I had my own notions of what does it mean to build a on-demand rocket. Obviously, at that time, it was very crude, but two or three things I luckily got right was, first, the core business case, right? That has never changed. A lot of things have changed since 2017, but the core business case never changed. So that I'm very thankful for, that I got that right early on. Second, I think the kind of people I met, starting from Moin, also to Prof, and then through Prof, Mr. Perumal, I think all these people, I mean, I could not have asked for a better group of people to start the company with, right? So that fell in place. Product is product, right? Product keeps evolving all the time. So that's different. But these things somehow fell in place. And yeah, that's how we started. So Agnikul was incorporated in Chennai. I think the date was December 1st, 2017. That is the date of it.
Okay. And initially you did not need funding because of the IIT Madras incubation. Like, they were giving you labs and people who would work with you and infrastructure and stuff like that.
Yeah, something like that, yes. But so three things helped us in the beginning, very few months, right? One is, both Moin and I had worked before, so there were some savings that we could put it, right? And then second, yes, you exactly said, being in an academic institution helps. Starting from cheaper food all the way to the right kind of access to people. In all these small things that count. For me, it was a very humbling experience, because I told you, right, we were managing portfolios worth millions and all billions, all these big 10 power 9 kind of numbers. But then again, I was here like, okay, actually today I can go and have food here, because it was really also unsettling, because we didn't know what's going to happen, right? So, but being in, always makes me feel good to be in a university setting. Always feels like there is so much hope and so much more to do from a university setting. So I love the part that, you know, I was able to get into and meet someone from IIT Madras, and IIT Madras was supporting. So yes, so it was not that bad. Third thing also was that Prof himself had students that he was working with who he could, you know, tell, hey, why don't you just go and talk to Srinath for some time, kind of a thing, where I got some free help as well. So all that was helping us, you know, slowly get started. Yeah, that's how we went about it in the initial phase.
So who was your first external investor, like our first major external investor?
So first major external investor was Vishesh. He's from a fund called Special. And you know, what happened is I ended up, so I was very new to the startup community here. And in the 10 years that I was not in India, all my friends who were with me, who were in startups, they're all like become founders, and everyone knew a lot of people, right? So I met a lot of funds at that time through them. So because by then people who stayed in India, they, you know, this was like when I was 31, 32. So by then, actually, you can imagine, right? People are already in a certain place in their career by that time. So met a lot of people, but Space Tech as a business was too foreign as an idea for most VCs in the country at that time. And most of them used to think, I mean, again, I won't blame any of them, right? Because it's the context. It's just a guy who's coming from the US here and he wants to build rockets. Like, what are you talking about, right? But then there was this one fund by name Special in Chennai, actually. And because all of the pitching used to be in Bangalore, 95% of the time. And I met someone in Chennai through a Thai Chennai event at IIT Madras incubation cell. And he seemed to understand this stuff. And I was very, like, surprised by that fact, that because I didn't know that they actually had a view on Space Tech. That was very early at that time. This was 2018, June, I'm talking about. So then that's about it. Then once that started, so once Vishesh and his team were interested in us, slowly we got used to what it means to work with a VC. And Vishesh is definitely one of the most founder-friendly VCs that I've met. So that made it easy, but he was the first person to put serious money in the company. So they invested $500,000.
Okay. And what did you use this money for? Tell me about that product evolution.
Oh, yeah. So first, this is again very clear to us because we had people like Mr. Perumal, Professor Satya. All these people were like, you know, very clearly telling us what has to be done, right? The framework for the development was very clear. It was more on the execution and the innovation part. So, yeah, the first thing was about building out engines. Engines, basically the way you build any vehicle for space, right? It could be a spacecraft, it could be a satellite, it could be a rocket. You basically get the engine right. And because you can't play with the engine too much, like what you do a lot of things and finally you get an engine and you're stuck with it. And then the rest of the rocket is built around the engine. That's how it goes. And this is the standard in the industry as well. So that's where we started. You had to first get the engine right. And so, yeah, we got the engine part done. Multiple tests happened. And then after that, I think by 2018 September, we were able to do a successful firing. And this was a conventionally manufactured rocket engine, meaning it was not in no 3D printing, nothing of that sort was happening then. And after that, we were able to...
What does it mean, successful firing? Like, did you actually build the whole rocket and then fire it? Or what does that mean?
We built the engine and then we put it on a mount. Like, you know, we basically harnessed it to the ground and then we just fired it as if it would be flying. But it is not flying. So, because actually for a rocket to fly, you need two things. You need an engine and you need autopilot. Basically, these two things have to be working together to keep the vehicle stable and fly. So this part was still in the engine stage. So we just had to put it on the ground and fly.
This you said middle of 2018 is when you had this successful firing of the engine.
First successful firing of the conventionally manufactured one. But we always knew that we had to 3D print our rocket engines. And this was because it was very clear that one of the slowest moving pieces in making a rocket is the rocket engine itself. And we had to be, you know, we wanted to automate it to a point where there is no human intervention involved at all. It should be like something just makes the engine and gives it to you. And this is what we are reading about other companies trying 3D printing for rocket engines and so on. We just, you know, we're pushing the boundaries ever so, you know, steadily. So, okay, we made 20% of the engine 3D printed. We made 40% 3D printed. And then now it is 100% 3D printed. And also you successfully test fired it. So yeah, lucky team has done extremely awesome, you know, development there. But that's basically the idea.
So this fundraise of $500,000 was also around the same time only, middle of 2018.
It was, yeah, around the end of 2018. Yes.
End of 2018. Okay. So what was 2019 like for you? Like, what were the milestones in that? Like 18, you had these two milestones of the fundraise and the successful test firing. Tell me about 19
was about scaling the team with this money that came in, also trying out this fully 3D printed engine, right? And also starting customer conversations. You know, we have to grow out of the lab, basically, right? That part of it, where you start looking at business aspects, you start talking to customers, you start talking to suppliers, you start talking to ISRO. All of those things started happening in 2019.
Did you build the rocket around the engine?
Yeah, that was the, obviously that product is continuing, and that is continuing to, you know, evolve, right? But I'm saying other than the vehicle development, a lot of other things also have to be done. So those things started by that time.
Like, how do you launch a rocket? Do you need a launch vehicle for that, or can you just put it on a ground somewhere and launch it? Like, how does the launch happen? What all are the things you need to do to actually get it off the ground?
Oh, okay. So actually, rocket and launch vehicles are synonymous terms, at least the way I've used it here. Launch vehicle is what you refer to, the right way to refer to a flying rocket is a launch vehicle, basically. So it is launched from a launch pedestal, basically. That's the phrase for the system that you are talking about, launch pedestal. So what do you need to do? So it's like a car that is, you know, ready to go in a F1 race or something, right? So basically you get everything assembled ready. You need to fuel it. You need to keep all of the programs that are needed for it to fly in the right manner. And then you fire the engines and let go. That's basically the idea. And the interesting part is every rocket that has ever flown to space has always been on autopilot. In fact, my understanding, autopilot as a theory itself developed from the need for launching rockets to space. Because things are happening so fast, you can't sit back and do any joystick control. So next time, if you actually end up watching a launch, and you'll see a lot of these people up in front of all these monitors, right? All of them are just watching.
Yeah, right. Yes, that's true.
So nothing can be done. You can basically just like wonder what's going on or be happy or celebrate what's going on. But the concept is that you let go and you wait and watch the fun. And not only you, the rest of the world gets to judge it with you. So in that sense alone, I still feel there is a small analogy to a film that can be made. Every rocket launch is like a film. It's a lot of money spent, and then you put it out there, everyone can get to judge it, and you can't really do much about it.
Right. Okay. So, in 19, did you actually launch a rocket also to space, or this was just...
No, we have not launched anything to space so far. Hopefully, by early next year, we'll be ready for that. So far, we've been fine-tuning. There's a lot of fine-tuning that goes in because you have very little margins when you're building a rocket from a mass standpoint, right? Otherwise, it doesn't get you all the way to orbit.
Okay. So you need to make it as light as possible. So you're constantly looking at how to make it lighter.
Yes, exactly right. So you're constantly doing that. You're fine-tuning. And usually, it's not a first-cut optimization that gets the job done. You need to think of like some five things that will all have to work together to get that reduction to be possible. I can give you some example, right? There is an example of where you push out fuel. And to push out fuel into your rocket engine, you need something called a pressurant, which actually pushes the fuel from the tank into the engine. Right? Now, you obviously have to take that also with you. Correct? But then to take that with you, you end up storing it in a liquid phase, basically because it, liquid occupies lesser volume. You can get by with smaller tanks. The very reason that the pressurant can be used as, and can be stored as a liquid is because the fuel is so cold. It is cryogenic oxygen. And that's why you're able to hold the pressure. Now, if the moment you lose the, if the fuel starts to heat up, you also lose your pressure. So these kind of like interconnected optimizations are there. So that is why the fine tuning takes a lot of time. But it's a very challenging experience to go through this.
Basically, there are a lot of moving parts and everything needs to work like a symphony in a way.
Yes, right. And the question or the challenge I always tell my team is, we all know that all human beings have some imperfection in them, but we all have to come together and build a perfect product, which I find is a fascinating challenge, actually. So because the passing grade is 100%, as they say, right, there is no scope for failure, no room for error. You can't reset your rocket in mid-flight. It's not like a phone if it hangs. It's not like you can just reset it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you basically get one shot and it has to work, and literally thousands of things have to work. And I find that as a very, from a pure human behavior standpoint, I find it a very fascinating challenge. How do a bunch of people who are all, you know, in some sense imperfect, right, come together and make a perfect product? That's the job of making rockets, basically.
Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating way to look at it. So, do you have like commitments from customers, and do you have like are the pieces falling in place? You would need some sort of a launch platform facility. Are those available off the shelf? And you would obviously have needed more money also. I'm sure that $500,000 wouldn't have lasted too long. So, tell me about how these pieces are all falling into place.
Yeah, sure. So it's all going quite well, luckily. So one thing that happened during 2020, so we spoke about 2019 some time ago. 2020, the good thing that happened is we were able to raise the next round of money. That was a pre-series A that was about $3.5 million. And also the other thing is right after that, COVID hit, right? And at that time is when the government came out with this new Atmanirbhar policy. Right. And there space got a free lift because they came up with this new entity called InSpace, which is going to be a parallel to ISRO just for authorization of private space programs. So all of the thing that you're talking about in terms of a place to launch from and in terms of authorization to launch, I think, again, being in the right place at the right time has helped us. So we are able to do that now.
So InSpace is something like try for private telecom companies. Like, it takes care of the regulation and disputes and allocating the wavelength spectrum and all of that. So is it something like that?
Loosely, it's an authorization body. Correct. So that happened, and at the same time, we had some successful engine firings. As I told you, we raised a couple of rounds of money, so customers also started taking us more seriously, right? And people also, the team also started to grow. So things are slowly falling in place. It's hardware. Hardware doesn't work, so that's the norm. So there is always, you're constantly tinkering, right? Tinkering is the norm, and you're constantly also fine-tuning in the process. But slowly, the other pieces of the puzzle are falling in place. Definitely, I would say that now I can see clear visibility on all areas, from a customer standpoint, from a launch mechanism standpoint, from an authorization standpoint, from a product standpoint. All these areas are very clear deliverables, very clear goals. Because as a startup, I think that's one thing to actually formulate is, right, you need clarity on the question. The answers will anyway come. You should know what questions to ask, and those things should be in place first, because otherwise it becomes open-ended and you don't know what you're trying to do and all that stuff. So luckily we have gotten over those points so far.
Okay. So like, you know, you said something very interesting, and I want to kind of understand that a bit more, that it's important to know what are the questions to ask rather than the answers, because the answers come. So what do you think are the questions that an entrepreneur should know? Like, you know, can you like talk a bit more about this?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I think the first thing is, what is a value addition, right? What is the real thing that you are bringing to the world? Because you might think it's a problem, but it's probably not a large enough problem, or it's not a problem at all. So are you actually solving a problem, or are you just doing something because you like? I think that's the first question. And it's a very hard question, because you need to be able to brutally face yourself, you know, and ask that question. Because there are always biases that we get into. Yeah, yeah, this will anyway happen. Yeah, yeah, there is a problem. Those things are always there, right? But to honestly get a third person's view, and it's very tough also, because there are a lot of skeptics around. Even if it's a genuine problem, people don't sometimes acknowledge it. Not because they don't want to, but because it's just not easy sometimes, right? So you'll have to figure that part out first. What is the true problem that you're solving? What is this, whether your solution is actually going to help people enough to give you money, right? That's a different level of a reassurance that you need for this business. The next thing is, I think, to create all the structures and put systems in place to keep things going. First 10 people can do anything, actually. Like, it doesn't matter, you don't need any systems, because you can literally talk to everyone every day. But the moment you go to 25, you need systems. The moment you go to 60, 70, you need really strong systems. Otherwise, you won't even know where inefficiencies are coming from, right? So that is the right set of questions that I'm talking about. Also, questions about what are each of these people going to use to communicate effectively within each other. So if you have like 5 teams, how are these teams going to talk? What is the language? I obviously don't mean English alone, right? I mean the manner in which communication, information flows within the company. So these are things to solve for and ask as questions first. No, and once you ask these questions, I think there are so many smart people around you and in the team that you will hire who can all solve it. I always find the biggest value addition that I bring to Agnikul also is from the questions I ask, not from answers, because there are much more smarter engineers than I'm. It's like a little bit like my New York experience. I'm talking to a lot of people who are 10x smarter than me, right in the design part. But I think the value addition I bring in is by giving them direction and asking the right questions.
Got it. Interesting. So what are some of the systems that you are using? Like, you know, what is your headcount now? I assume it must have crossed 60.
Yeah, we are at 80 now.
So what kind of systems do you have in place for them to work well together, for them to communicate? How does information flow? Like, are you using off-the-shelf stuff, or have you got something custom built, or, you know, what is your technology stack?
It's a combination of both. It's not only about using existing tools or something. It's actually a manner of doing work, right? Like putting systems in place for people to... So I told you about that contradiction, right? How do a bunch of imperfect people come together to build a perfect product? The answer is, you don't let people fail. That's the answer. And the way we do that is by having enough checkpoints in between, so that people, even if they by mistake do an error or something, you find a space to hold them. So I always tell this to the team as well, that, you know, like, remember that you or your colleague or both of you together can make mistakes, but put in place something wherein if you make a mistake, he'll catch you, or if he makes a mistake, you will catch it. So that could mean like introducing verifications where necessary. That could mean like, you know, like having a third person reviewer. That could mean like always having a sanity check. Does this make sense? When you're neck deep in a design, you should take that 5 minutes out once a week to just come out and, hey, what am I doing here? Right? That kind of things. Those are the systems I'm talking about. So we have a lot of that going. We also try to have a lot of focus on product as opposed to function, because you could talk engines, you could talk tanks, but in the end, the rocket is a rocket. It's a combination of all technologies. So we should always think, you know, what are we doing that will deliver something to the vehicle as opposed to, okay, I've done this simulation right, or I've done this this formula right. And that is only one part of the story. So that alone, just that ability to think beyond those boundaries, functional boundaries, actually helps people.
Okay. And do you use like some workflow tools or project management tools, or what do you use for communication? Or these are like nothing special?
Yeah, nothing special. It's a usual productivity tools that anyone else is using. It's about the systems that we have within the company in terms of how people should use it. It's not about the tool, it's about how people use the tool. Right? I remember there was this phase in Agnikul where everyone was hooked onto this app called Asana to manage tasks. Have you heard of Asana before?
Yeah, I have, yeah. Project management.
Yeah, exactly. And it's amazing how after 10 days, no one wants to try that. Right? So okay. Then is when I realized that it's not about the tool, it's about how you use the tool. And there are so many tools out there. It's not a and there are some really cool tools as well, right? But the point is, like, what are we putting in place because of the tool? So that, I think, creating innovative ways to get people to, you know, do that is where I think I add the most value. I think where my co-founder Mohini also adds the most value. It's like, I think a CEO role, or probably any co-founder role, is a big HR role is there. You're constantly talking about how to improve communication within the team.
Okay. And tell me about your customers now. So there is like a customer base falling in place. So are these like companies from India? Are they global companies? What, you know?
It's both. It's very international, and there are also local players, local in the sense within the country players. So yeah, I think, see, space is actually very global in nature, right? So very rare to find customers only within one country or something like that.
But wouldn't there be a logistics cost of shipping the satellite to India, like if someone has built a satellite in the US, or it's immaterial, like it's a small fraction of the...
It is a fraction of the actual launch cost, yeah.
Okay.
And also there are certain geographic locations that are better off for launching to certain orbits. So it's almost like, yeah, it is going to be a bit of an initial cost to come to India to launch, but then from India you get access to orbits that you can't get access to from some other places in the world. So that alone makes India just a good point. And then after that, it's about how good your product is and what you're really trying to offer and all that stuff.
Okay. And what kind of companies are these? Like, is it like companies offering broadband internet or like what?
Yeah. So you go to space only for two reasons, largely. One is you go there and take pictures of Earth. Or I joke about it in the team as, you know, we are all in some level enabling selfies from space. That's right. The ultimate selfie, yeah. With Earth in your background, you're going to go and take a picture of something. But, I mean, of course, there are a lot of applications to taking pictures. People track logistics with that today. People track... you know, how weather patterns are changing, people track how land usage is changing, projects are evolving, all that stuff. And the other big industry is communication, which is an example of what you said is the internet part. There is now Internet of Things, and there are separate satellite systems for that. Communication, 4G, 5G, whatever, all of the cell phone eventual, you know, usage goes there. So, yeah, all of those things come together in the customers.
Okay. And like, who are the investors who backed you now after Special, like the subsequent fundraisers that happened?
Oh, so we had Pi Ventures lead the next round. And after that, we had other people like Artha and Globevestor also come in. Then in this recent round...
These are all Pi... Indian...
Yes. And then recently we raised $11 million round, and there we did, the round was led by Mayfield India, and then a host of other angels who also participated. So, yeah.
Did it get easier in subsequent rounds? Did it get harder?
I mean, every round is unique. That's one thing I've learned. Just because I've raised funds three times now doesn't mean I will be easy the fourth time. So fundraising is hard. Actually, one of my friends used to tell me this very early on when I started. He's actually running a successful startup here. He used to say, good people and fundraising are always hard, no matter the scale of the startup. So that is true. But of course, you get to know how people think. You get to know how to tell a story. You get to know what exactly people are looking for. I mean, at the end of it, fundraising is about convincing someone that they can put money.
How did the conversations change from round to round? Like, you know, how did their questions to you change from one round to the next?
They were very different focus points, right? Like in the first round, seed round, it was about idea and, you know, core product and founders themselves, like me and Moin and Prof and all that. Second round was more about the ability to scale, the ability to do proof of concept hardware, the ability to talk to customers, all that. And now this last round was more about commercialization. What next after this? What after first launch? It was very different focus areas.
Mm-hmm. So in this last round, they would have asked you about the unit economics per launch. How much will you earn?
Yeah.
And stuff
yeah,
like
yeah, okay. Exactly. Those kind of questions. Yes, yes, yes. It becomes much more about a profitability part and all that also.
Okay. So are you at liberty to talk about, how does a space company make money? Like, what is it that you charge to a customer and what do you earn from one rocket? How many launches in a year will you be doing? And, you know, the more economics part of the business or the finance part?
I'll probably not give direct answers there. I'm going to talk around the beat around the bush a little bit there intentionally. But I'll say that, yeah, at least, I mean, we are in the business of reducing time to go to space, right? Waiting time. So it's a bit like instead of taking a bus that will only go at certain times, we are giving you a cab to go to space, right? So that is what we're building. So we give you that advantage at the same cost that you will take, that a bus will take you. So we are on par or slightly cheaper than the industry standard today.
But what is the industry standard like for one satellite? Is it like a per kilo payload? Or
yeah, it's a per kg payload. It's like an Amazon truck actually. Like, this is a business of getting things from point A to point B. It's a transportation business. Launch vehicle company like Agnikul, we are building the truck and also driving the truck. That's basically the idea, right? So, you usually charge on a per kg basis, how much ever you take to space, depending upon where you start and where you stop.
What is the benchmark per kg?
It's around $30,000 per kg, roughly, today, for these small satellites.
And how many kgs does your satellite be carrying? Like, what is the plan?
A vehicle has a capacity to scale between 30 to 300. You can take as little as 30 and be profitable. You can go as high as 300 and still the vehicle will have capacity. That's the rate.
How is that possible? Like 30 to 300 is a fairly large range.
Yeah, that is actually one of our USPs actually. So we build our rockets like how typically laptops with RAM slots are built, right? So if you want higher processing power, you add a couple of RAM slots, right? RAM to your computer, right? Very similarly, we built it in such a manner that the vehicle can be scaled up and down.
So you can add one section or you can add another engine and increase the capacity. Okay. That's amazing. Okay. And how many rockets will you build? Is it now like clear on whether it's a reusable rocket or like, you know, tell me about that actual part of like, you know, when you launch the rocket, what happens next?
Oh, then it's about launching more frequently and really getting to on demand, right? Getting them to launch within a 2-week time frame at best.
Now, tell me about your hypothetical launch. Like, you know, what are all the things that will get checked off before the launch? Once it launches, what will happen? Like that, if you can, like, paint a picture of that one launch happening.
So a customer indicates that he or she wants to put, say, 10 kgs in space. So they contact us and then we configure a rocket for them based on where they are launching from, where they want to go to and how much they weigh.
Will you be clubbing customers or it's like...
We could. It depends on the customers. It depends on the orbit. It depends on the target. For this example, I'll just take it's one customer. We get their satellite. So we agree on that. We agree on the mission. We agree on the trajectory. We agree on other metrics that matter for the satellite. Then we integrate there and then we ask them to basically ship the satellite. Then it gets integrated with the rocket. Then the rocket itself is taken on a mobile launch pad.
And the rocket is custom built for that launch.
Yes.
Based on the payload, you will custom build it.
Exactly. Based on the payload and the target orbit they want to get. And yeah, so we take them in a launch. We take the vehicle along with the satellite in a, you know, to the launch pad. Say, let's say Sriharikota.
How far is that? And where will the rocket be made? And where will it go for the launch?
It'll be made in Chennai. It will be launched from Sriharikota.
How far is that?
60 to 70 kilometers, I think, roughly.
So the whole rocket goes on top of a truck, or like how does that?
Yes. It goes on top of a trailer, of a large trailer.
Okay. That must be quite a sight on the road.
Yeah, right. We're also waiting for that moment. So you go there, then you go to the launch pad, then you get set up. Basically, you have a bunch of other trailers that go along with the rocket. Trailer wherein you have pumping stations, fueling stations, then you know the ground systems for checkout and all those things. Then you take it to the launch pad, you erect it, you make it vertical basically, and then you fill the fuel, and then everything is right. You start the countdown. Countdown is basically a series of checks that happen at a very well-defined set of time intervals. So at every time you come, basically as you're counting down, different things are being given an okay by the flight computer on the ground computer.
Okay, like fuel and the electronics working, the communication working.
Yeah. Every single system. There are literally hundreds of systems. And everything has to be flawless, right? So that check happens. And then finally, at the time that you're planned, you basically switch on your engines. And once you develop thrust, you let go and then watch.
Okay. So there is an onboard computer which does the navigation.
Yeah. The entire navigation is done by an onboard computer. You can't do anything from ground even if you want to. It's going too fast.
And how powerful is that computer? Is it like equivalent to, let's say, a Snapdragon 8 series or like?
Nah, it's very simple actually. It's probably like... it's probably like what was there in like a 90s or the pagers and the early cellular phones, right? That kind of processor is more than enough. See, because you're actually not doing very very complicated stuff, because in the end, whatever computation you do, mechanical hardware doesn't react as fast as electronics hardware. You have an engine that has to be doing the job for you. Whatever you do, that is finally going to be in milliseconds, not in nanoseconds or microseconds. So it's actually, you can take your time with it, but you're going very fast, so you can't interfere and you can't bring in humans into the process. But because still it's millisecond level decisions, right? But millisecond level decisions are like a child's play for today's processes. We are talking micro nanoseconds today, so milliseconds is like literally 100x slower. So.
Okay. And once it is out of the atmosphere, then what? Like it goes to a specific location in the orbit. Does it completely exit the atmosphere?
Yeah. It goes up to a certain high. So the atmosphere that, as we know it, becomes very thin by 40, 50 kilometers. After that, it's basically, thinner and thinner atmosphere. Technically, yes, there is atmosphere, but that's more like theoretical atmosphere.
So, till what height does it go?
Yeah, as I said, 40 to 50-ish kilometers, you can say there is some meaningful atmosphere. After that, it's very, very rarefied. And beyond 100 or so, practically doesn't exist, you can say.
So your rocket will go till what height?
So, rocket goes to 700, up to 700. Depends on the customer, but it goes up to 700.
And then once it reaches the desired height, then what?
Once it reaches the desired height, it ejects the satellite out. So basically, going to orbit means going to a certain height and actually, giving enough velocity to a satellite. So in that process, you end up going fast yourself. That's what a rocket does. You, along with your satellite, go very, very, very fast. And once you've attained the velocity for that height, you just basically push the satellite gently out. That's it.
Okay. And through the momentum, the satellite stays on that orbit only.
Yeah, it just continues. There's nothing to stop it, right? Basically, space is very benign in that sense. Atmosphere is where all the action is. Once you go to space, there's nothing there. Satellite folks usually take care of radiation protection and thermal protection, all that. Once you take care of those couple of things, it simply just stays there. There is nothing. You will basically work till the point where simply the life runs out of your components because there is nothing else that can kill you. That's how you hear about these Voyager probes that are well beyond Pluto now, right? Launched in 1960s, right? They'll just keep going. There's nothing. So this atmosphere is where all the action is.
Is there like a risk of getting hit by debris?
Not in a launch. Launch is for like 10 minutes, 15 minutes, right? So debris is not a real problem. We do have deorbiting protocols in place so that we don't let anything stay in space for a while. So our rockets, I'm saying, the satellites deorbiting will happen from a satellite customer standpoint. For a rocket standpoint, we'll go put ourselves there and we basically just slow down ourselves a little bit. And that means slowly over a period of time, we'll come decay back into our orbit, we'll come back to Earth.
And when it comes back, does it like land the way we see those videos of SpaceX, like landing back?
No. This is like more like burning off in atmosphere itself completely.
Okay, so it's a one-time use rocket, basically.
It's an expendable rocket, both the first stage and the second stage of the rocket. Yes, it's an expendable rocket.
What is the first stage and second stage? When do they kick in?
There's usually different parts to a rocket. So what you do is you consume a lot of fuel and then you throw off some part of your rocket because you're just carrying empty tanks. So that's what is called a stage. And so ours is a two-stage rocket.
And both these stages get burnt off. They're not really.
Mostly fully burnt off. Yes. Second stage, definitely. First stage, too, mostly.
Okay.
So, Srinath, tell me, what is the journey of a rocket? Like, you know, from the time that the demand comes to you till the time that the whole project is like closed.
Sure. So basically, the journey is the journey of an Amazon delivery truck, right? Nothing more fancy than that. I hope I didn't destroy that with too much simplicity there. But I mean, essentially, that's what happens, right? So a customer sends us a requirement, a mission, and we agree on it. And then he or she ships the satellite to our place, and we integrate it with the rocket. So that's a little... I mean, essentially, it's like plugging a USB into the rocket, but, you know, it's always a little more complex than that. You have to make sure everything works. There's a checkout. The rocket and the satellite are able to talk to each other. Once that is done, the vehicle is fully assembled.
It could also be like a payload from 2-3 different customers that you combine into a rocket.
That could also be that. Yes, that, right. So in that case, then we wait for other people to come in as well. Or, again, we are okay with dedicated launches. So it depends really on what is the minimum mass. Like once they cross like 30-40 kgs, we're good to go. Then we assemble the vehicle, put it on a trailer, and then
you have a 3D printing process, right? So you would have like the 3D printing happening then and there, or like
so it depends upon the exact requirement, right? But we probably will have inventory worth for at least one rocket. But on the side, yeah, you can obviously start printing the engines as well on the side, start making the tanks as well. All these things could happen. But I'm expecting there is some inventory in there, right? So the rocket is integrated with the nose cone part of it, and then the tanks are integrated to that, and then the engine. Then the same thing happens to the, say, first stage, the bottom stage, where there's a long tanks. And I mean, you might be aware of this, but just to reiterate, a rocket is mostly just tanks, right? There's a little bit of engine stuff at the bottom. There is one small satellite on top, but otherwise it's a lot of just empty tanks. That's what any rocket is. Anytime you see a rocket, remember that you're seeing a bunch of tanks.
Okay. Okay.
In the bottom you have engines, in the top you have the satellite. That's it. So we integrate that based on what some combination of what's in the inventory, what will be live 3D printing and stuff. Then the rocket is put together. And then this whole journey, like a road trip starts, basically, not just of the rocket and then all its supporting systems go in another 40 feet, trailer. It's all about like 40 feet container based approaches to taking the rocket from point A to the launch pad, wherever that is. So we go there. And then So that'll be like, say, the filling station, the pumping station, the water cooling station, the, you know, some of the stations for monitoring the performance of the rocket, you know, the one that you see on TV, right, where the people, bunch of people sitting on a monitor and looking at what's going on. All of these things, along with the data acquisition systems for that, we move all of that along with this. So it'll be like this fleet of 40-foot containers going to the launch pad. On the launch pad, you again start assembling these together. You basically erect the vehicle. The vehicle was horizontal so far. You basically make it vertical. Then you give a lot of connections. You connect the plumbing, the electrical ones. There's a lot of things that the rocket, it's basically like you're charging the vehicle for its batteries. You're filling the tank. It's getting ready for the journey, right?
So plumbing is for the cooling? Like, what is the plumbing for?
The plumbing is for filling the tanks, basically. And then also for the jet plumes that come out for cooling them. Yes. So all this while, a bunch of people who are sitting on the other side, in the mission control room and just checking if every single sensor is working. And we have a bunch of them that runs well into the high triple digit, right? And then there are valves and the computer stuff. So every electronic board goes through an elaborate testing mechanism where after they went to the launch pad, because you want to make sure that you didn't miss out on anything in the journey to the launch pad, right? So that happens. So once all that is done, basically, then we say, okay, we'll officially start the countdown.
Okay. And how many days does it take to reach countdown? Like, you know, from when you dispatch it to the road till...
So usually it's about 2 to 3 days of work on the launch pad. So I'm discounting the journey to the launch pad, right? Because that's just simply very slowly driving the vehicle. That's a little boring. But once you get to the launch pad, it's about getting through to the check there, right? So that's what we basically do. Once that part is over, the next step here is to make sure that we are officially ready to start the countdown. Once we start the countdown, basically, what is a countdown? A countdown is a manner, a very, very disciplined and organized manner of checking everything in the rocket. That's all a countdown is. So you basically have a very elaborate checklist. And you do it with the time involved to it. So just so that, you know, people are all coming together. It's literally a management process, basically. And you just keep checking every second this happens, that happens. So many things have to be done. And there is a time angle to it as well, because usually your launch point or your launch window, as they call it, right? The time of launch is fixed. Because at that point in time, you've already notified, people in the sea, you've notified airmen flying around that there's going to be a rocket. So that part is fixed. So you're going to go back and try to figure out all these things, right? Just to make sure that you time it all right, so that when that moment comes, you're ready to go. That's what a countdown is. In the meantime, two other things that have happened. You'd have alerted the range safety people of the launch pad when they let you inside their premises. So they'll be making sure that the vehicle is able to talk to them. And just to be very clear, when it talks to them, we can't interfere. They have full authority to kill the vehicle if they want to, because if it's doing something wrong, we can't have it be an hazard, right? So that has to be so that they have the ability to stop the mission at any point, both before and after liftoff, right? So that happens. And then after that, we continue working on this, checking. This core vehicle team is only doing checking all the time. That's all 48 hours of this checking. On the other side, people are all getting busy trying to get all the other clearances ready, making sure that all of the, notices are in place. Seamen, airmen have been notified and all that. And then what happens is somewhere around 4 to 5 hours before, we start the fuel filling process. Fuel filling process is actually, first it is done for all of the kerosene stuff. So we have kerosene, liquid oxygen engines, the kerosene stuff. That part starts and all of that filling happens. The batteries are charged. Vehicle is basically, you move all the parts that are moving and you see whether things move. It's literally like warming up, right? There's a warm-up exercise that happens. And after that, you start putting in the fuel that is a little more complex to handle, which is liquid oxygen, right? So the liquid oxygen loading starts. And that's a slow process because you have to cool the engine, and then only you have to load it and all that happens. But you're basically getting to the last phase of launch, right? So by now the vehicle is fully, getting ready. Once the oxygen is in place fully, that is basically it. I mean, after this, you don't have time actually, because if you leave it, oxygen will again start evaporating. Right. So that's about the last bit. In fact, I think we try to do it all the way to about 10 minutes or so before launch, 20, 15 minutes. But yeah, whatever. Like, you can decide that based on the mission, based on the requirements and local geography and all that stuff. This happens, and then once that process is over, all the manual checks get completed, and then we basically transfer control to the flight computer. So far, you were controlling everything from the ground computer. You were turning on valves, turning off valves. Everything was being done by a human. But at some point, like, this usually happens about 60 seconds to 120 seconds before liftoff, you give control to the flight computer. And the reason is you don't want to do that at the last minute, because anyway, finally, the flight computer only has to do the job. And doing that too last minute will give you very little time to react in case things are going wrong. So you give control to the flight computer, and in the meantime, you immediately check if everything is still okay, because now you have basically given control to someone else, right? And then
it must be like very nervous 2 minutes, like those last 2 minutes.
Countdown, and even we do our engine firing, and I think we did one last week as well. And every countdown, whether it is for a ground test or a launch or whatever, is always nervous, because you there is a time ticking, and at the same time, a lot of things have to go right, and you have one shot at it basically, right? So it's sort of that moment. So this happens, yeah. And so you do the last, you keep, now you can't do any checks. The flight computer is doing checks and simply reporting the data to you. And you're just hoping that everything is okay. And then it, usually the thing that gets announced on mic and all that is the last 10 seconds, right? It up to lift off. So at around T-minus 3 or 4 seconds, your engines come to life. Basically, you make sure that all of the engines are producing enough thrust. And that happens for a certain, like 1 or 1.5 seconds usually. And then after that point, you let go. And that's it. Vehicle basically lifts off. It goes straight up for some time just to clear obstacles. And then it does a little bit of a pitch over. Pitch over in the sense it gently tilts in to the ocean. Basically, you want to go over the, you want to go into a tangential direction, right? You basically in orbit, for being in orbit, you need to be parallel to the ground, not perpendicular. So you kind of pitch over, and that'll also take you over the ocean, where you feel a lot better, because now you're over ocean. Even if things go wrong, there's no problem for anyone. So that happens, and in between this, you would have had the first milestone. Basically, you cleared your launch pad. So that itself is a big thing, because no vehicle is perfectly stable. So the moment you let go, the vehicle will try to tilt over in some direction. Right, it's a little bit like trying to balance a pen on its tip, right? So the moment you let go, it will try to fall, but then you're continuously correcting for it and clearing. So once you clear launch pad, then you do the pitch over, and then you keep going, and then the vehicle goes through it really rapidly gains velocity. And there comes a point which is called the max Q point, which is the point where the vehicle faces the maximum load, right? And usually if you watch a launch, and even for us, that is a big moment. Once you cross that moment, you basically know that the vehicle has been through the worst. So that's the point where usually there is a lot of applause in the mission control room, because you know the vehicle has borne the brunt of most of the problems, right? So then you continue on your journey. After that, it keeps gaining velocity and altitude. And at a point comes where your stage one is basically not very useful anymore. You've almost burnt all your fuel in it. So when the right moment comes, you kill your engines there. You basically shut off your engines, and then you basically, the flight computer actually tells the stage to separate. So the stage then falls off, and the remaining part of
that stage would be like the lower, the bottom half of the rocket, yeah, or yeah. Something yes, like yes, that.
Yes. And then that falls off, and in the second stage, which is now there, it continues. It fires,
and that typically falls into the ocean, and that's like a one-time use.
That's a one-time use rocket, yes. And what SpaceX has done, for example, is to catch that and bring it back, or try to bring it back directly. But basically, yeah, that's exactly what happens. Second stage continues. For us, it's a two-stage rocket, so second stage continues and it keeps going. Second stage is actually very easy in a way, because you're outside atmosphere, and trust me, you're going on a journey of 600 kilometers, but the first 10 kilometers is where all the problems are, because of atmosphere. It's unpredictable. There are winds and there is a lot happening on the rocket. Like, for example, if we were to, for some reason, go and live on the moon, launching rockets would not at all be a big deal. There is no atmosphere. Yeah. Most of the problems come when there is atmosphere. So you're outside there and then you have a lot more lever to, you know, go in whatever attitude you want, direction you want. You can face where you want. And eventually, you slowly make your way towards making, going towards the light point that you want to get into in orbit. And when you're close enough there, if you basically, once you get into that moment, right, at that point, you know that your satellite, you've reached the point where your satellite wants to go to, and then you eject your payload. And it's just basically literally pushed out with a very gentle velocity. It's almost like pushing a door, like closing a door. That kind of push is all that is given. And after that, the satellite just continues on its way to orbit. And with that, the vehicle itself is done with its job. So it basically, what it does, something called passivation. It empties itself of all the fuel because it's going to be floating there for a bit before coming down. We don't want any accidents to happen in case there is a collision or something. So you do something called passivation or basically making the vehicle inert, right? And you're there for some time, and then after that,
what is some time, like a couple of days or?
It could be a couple of weeks, maybe, or a little more. But you slowly decay down, and it's a very positive feedback process. Like the more you go down, the more you'll be pulled faster down because you lose speed rapidly because of atmosphere. But that takes some time. It's like a spiral inward. Towards Earth, and yeah, and then you fall back. But
and you're able to predict where it will fall, like,
yeah, reasonably well. But more importantly, for small rockets like ours, it completely burns up on the way back. There'll be nothing left. It won't even actually have an impact. There is very little left in the vehicle when it comes back. So fully burn up. That's it. In the meantime, the satellite that has been ejected will wake up. Till now, it has been on sort of sleep mode. So, and then it wakes up once you get to, once it has been put out, and then it slowly, literally starts testing one system at a time. Hey, are you okay? And it starts communicating to Earth, and then literally starts with a hello world, and slowly goes back to full waking up state, and then it starts doing its job based on what people below say. So a satellite's thing is very, it need not be automated. Because you have a lot of time. Worst case, hey, you know what? Just wait for some time. It'll come back again over you. Right. Rocket is not like that. So, but yeah, that's basically the idea.
Amazing. This whole journey gives me goosebumps. It just sounds, I mean, you know, sounds like something out of what I would have read in science fiction when I was a kid.
Right. Yeah. It's still, we do this day in and day out, and even for us, it's actually fascinating to think of it. Every countdown makes me nervous, makes me get that high, right? It's an adrenaline, you know, pumping event. Any day, how many times you do it?
So, you know, you had told me that you learned about rules of thumb, and you know, what are like the rules of thumb for a rocket company? Like, do you have like some of those in your mind?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's all I talk about to the team. So, yes, definitely. One thing, the first rule of thumb is how much of mass that you add to one stage will take you, will how much payload will it cost you, right? So, in your first stage, for example, if you put in, say, I'm just randomly picking numbers here because I don't want to talk about our rocket. But generally speaking, right, say, for example, if you add 10 kgs to your first stage, right, 1 kg of your actual payload capacity is gone. So, and we have these, it's not perfect, but it's a very helpful metric. So if someone comes in, you know, is brainstorming, okay, I need to either add 10 kgs or I need to pay up another $100,000, then it's easy to make those decisions once you know this. So that's one rule of thumb. The other rule of thumb is mostly on the lines of, okay, in case your engine is down in efficiency or performance by 1%, what is the orbit you're going to, how much error will you have in your orbit, right? So, 1% drop in engine performance is 10 kilometers of altitude. So, that is another metric that we try to, you know, constantly check with. And then there are all sorts of sensitivities. What happens if 1 kg of extra fuel is added? What happens if 1 kg of extra fuel leaks? And we always talk about it in terms of payload capacity.
So that those kind of rules of thumb are useful. Then comes the question of, I mean, this probably, I think, is outside of a rocket company as well, right? But I mean, at least for us, we use. So how long can you wait on a decision? Right? I always use that. I try to parameterize opportunity cost in the company. So I say, okay, you waited for 2 days. Let's say this is the, like, 50 people are working in the team. Each of those people, each of those persons are actually spending, say, about 20% of their time on it. So that's like about, say, 10 people roughly, right? 10 people working full time. What's their salary? And 2 days of not getting the job done, what's the opportunity cost for that? So I always say, use that as a rule of thumb to make quick decisions, because sometimes the trade-offs are really, really tight. And sometimes you get into the action of making a very elaborate trade-off as opposed to being decisive. I'm sure other companies do this as well, but this is something that we use all the time.
No, that's fascinating. That way to think about decision making is fascinating.
Oh, is it? Okay? Because I actually got the inspiration for it from AXA when I was in New York, right? And they had this. I had this manager who actually once started timing the cost of every meeting. Okay, it was amazing stuff. So every time you go in and come out of the meeting, I mean, obviously, I didn't know everyone's salaries, but then he had his assistant do it for us. And it'd be like, hey, you know what? That meeting just cost us $10,000. We better get something done. Like, what? It was just like 70 people sitting and talking. And it was $10,000 gone. So it just ingrained in me this idea that actually, you know what? You should put a meter to your meetings so that you know what you're spending. It really actually directly measures the value of time. And to be very clear, that's only half the measurement, right? Because there is a lot of hidden things that happen when you don't do things. Like, for example, let's say I was supposed to do a launch today, but I'm only doing it tomorrow. And because of that, I lose credibility with the customer or something. How do you put a value on that? That's very hard. But outside of that, these things are very obvious to measure. So, this is some rules of thumb and some tricks we use to be decisive and keep things focused.
So, what is like your, wildest dream about Agnikul? Like, you know, one is you would have, of course, like, you know, more short-term ambitions. But you know, so for example, do you see, like, say, SpaceX valuation is around 70, 80 billion. Do you see Agnikul becoming a competitor to SpaceX and Blue Origin as like your long-term wild dream? Like, you know, what are those dreams like?
So my long-term wild dream with Agnikul is really actually not too much on the financial side. I mean, I do think if you do the right things, people will pay us for it and automatically money and valuation and all that will come. I really want to make it look like, going to space shouldn't be that big a deal for anyone or anything. And I think I told this multiple times to team as well, right? Like it should... Getting to space should be like getting to a country that's quite far away from India, not more than that. Like if you can, from India, if you can go to the US, I mean, from India, you should be able to go to space. Interestingly, India to US, I think, is like some 12,000 miles. And we're talking 700 kilometers, right? Chennai to Hyderabad, I think, is more than that. So you just have to do it in the right direction. That's all it takes, right? So I feel like that part should be simplified. So I think, in being a competitor or, you know, being as big as Blue Origin or SpaceX is definitely a nice ambition to have as a means to that goal, right? I feel like because they're doing different things and I think they have been an inspiration in some ways and they obviously we can compete with them as well. It might come to that finally. But the point is not that. The point is to make sure that, okay, we should be like today. I think if you tell me you're going from Chennai to Delhi, I'd be like, okay. And just go on with other things. It should be like that to go to lower orbit at
least. So you like satellites is just step one. Like you would eventually also want to have human beings.
Yeah, definitely. Transportation in all forms and manner for both things and people and everything. Definitely, yes. It's the most natural progression, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and would you look at, like, you know, there are different approaches that different companies are taking, you know, like Virgin has its own approach and SpaceX has its own approach and Blue Origin has its own approach. So, which of these approaches are you more bullish about that you think would be a better bet in terms of when you reach that large scale transportation kind of a scenario?
Oh, I think both companies and in fact everyone is now focused on, it's becoming a privatized commodity, right? Transportation as such to space. So it is definitely about making costs affordable, making it like a, you know, like a meaningful transportation business. I mean, a lot of people today know how to run a transportation business, right? For ground transportation, and the same rules apply to space transportation as well. So I think all those approaches definitely work. I think right now the biggest problem to solve for is both the cost it takes to go to space. I really think it should get ridiculously cheap. We are talking about reduction in prices of the order of 1,000 times from where it is today, right? Only then I think it will become truly everyone's thing to do it. Otherwise, again, you're going to have it like being only approachable for a certain group of people, which will always keep it as an elite thing, right? As opposed to saying, hey, it's just 700 kilometers. I mean, everyone can go from Chennai to Hyderabad, so you should be able to go that much higher in space. So that's, I think the approach-wise, both companies, at least SpaceX and Blue Origin, both do things very differently. But everyone is trying to make it cheap. I think that part everyone is unified on.
But what, I mean, are you also looking at reusable in the future as a strategy, or, you know, like any, like in terms of what approaches they are taking, any preferences which you think, or any judgment call on which is a good approach?
Reusability. I think what SpaceX is doing is very much about actually being reusable in a planet where there is no atmosphere, right? Because they don't want to use air to come back. Blue Origin actually has never gone truly orbital before, but for space transportation, I think what they're doing is definitely a cool thing. This going up and coming back down. Both those are propulsive landings, right? So those are good. But I think, see, generally my perspective on reality is, on reusability is, it really depends on what is the cost you're saving, right? It is a, if you think about why reuse, it's a question of cost. Now, the thing that not many people, at least outside the industry, they don't talk about is what is the cost of reusing something, right? So you compare the cost of reusing to cost of throwing it away. Okay, what is the cost of reusing? Cost of reusing has two things in it. One is you always give up on payload capacity when you try to reuse a vehicle. Like, for example, Falcon 9, the SpaceX vehicle, actually burns its engines a little bit before coming down, right? Only then it's able to slow itself, right? And it has a variety of hardware on the rocket to make sure it is able to come back. Now, the revenue that they have given up trying to reuse their rocket, right? The revenue that goes into, the payload that is lost in terms of capacity, the revenue that goes into, or the money that goes into the other hardware, and then, of course, the money that goes into refurbishing, right? That should be actually less than the cost of the stage itself. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense, right? It's a simple mathematical relation at that point. So I feel for a very small rocket, it becomes like a use and throw pen. It just doesn't make sense to say, if I'm having 100 kg capacity, right? Let's say I end up spending 40 kgs to reuse my, paying in terms of payload capacity, 40 kgs to just get my vehicle back. I've lost half my revenue. Right. So why, unless it makes sense that, you know, the part of the vehicle that I'm saving is actually worth half my revenue, why would I do that? Now, the equation tilts actually in favor of larger vehicles doing that, because for them, it'll not be 100 to say 60 kgs, right? It could be like, say, 10 tons to 6 tons. Now, that's a lot. 4 tons is a lot. And because that way, you get paid in per kg, right? Dollars per kg. So that's a lot. And that's why I think a Falcon 9 reusability makes sense. Like Agni-1 reusability right now, from whatever basic calculations we have, it still feels like it's too close. Right? Yeah, you might save a little. Of course you save a little, but is it worth it is the question. So when we go to larger rockets, yeah, definitely we'll also explore that.
Okay. So my last question to you. You know, you envision a future in which space travel is just like going from Chennai to Hyderabad. How do you think that will change the way a human society is? You know, like, for example, way back in the 50s and 60s when computers had just come in, people probably did not see, or some people might have seen how pervasively computers will change society. But so what do you think space travel will do to humanity?
Wonderful question. So I think two things will happen, right? First of all, being able to see Earth from a distance will increase our sense of, you know, unity, sense of, you know, the being together. I mean, that is it, right? Like that is that once you can see the entirety of the planet in one shot, the feeling that that is everything that you have ever experienced will quickly sink in, right? So I feel actually it'll bring everyone closer. All of the boundaries that exist, if you look at all of the man-made boundaries, I mean, right, sovereign nations, borders, international borders, airspace, I mean, all of that would just melt away once you look at the planet from far enough, because you understand.
There are no nation boundaries visible from space.
Exactly, right? Only land versus water, that's about it. And that's how the planet has was and has always been. So that'll happen. So it's a very powerful feeling, I think. And also, I'm a big fan of Arthur C. Clarke, novels, right, as I told. So, and he always talks about how space is going to be the final factor that unifies humanity, because if enough people are able to see Earth for what it is, right, it'll really bring people together, and I truly believe in that. Second thing I think is it'll make us appreciate how precious the planet is, right? You know, once you go up, you'll realize that it's mostly empty except for this one blue ball below, which is where you have to be. Right, and that feeling is that we'll immediately tell you that, oh my God, I better take care of my planet. So you'll get that, I think, that change in perspective. I think a lot of astronauts actually experience that, is what I've read. It is like they can never see Earth again the same way. It just changes their perspective on how precious our planet is for all of us. So that would happen. And I also think the last thing that would happen is you truly start understanding the context of, you know, where our species fits in the big picture, the big questions that, you know, the existential questions, right? Who am I? What do I do? I think it basically, people will all become slightly more philosophical. And I think that's a good thing for all of us.
Right. Yeah, and I'm sure you're looking forward to piloting or being on the first Agnikul human carrier's rocket.
Yeah, definitely. I do now need to check with my wife on that, but yeah, it's definitely in the plan.
Okay, great. All right, cool.
To follow the journey of Agnikul and keep a tab on India's first private sector rocket launch, do visit agnikul.in.
You like the Founder Thesis podcast? Then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.
This episode of Founder Thesis Podcast is brought to you by Long Haul Ventures. Long Haul Ventures is the long haul partner for founders and startups that are building for the long haul. More about them is at www.longhaulventures.com.